Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and you're listening to the Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of March 25th, 2011. This hour, we're exploring money through the ages.
The earliest memory of money that I have is of not having enough.
The only thing I remember about money when I was younger is don't go into debt. Debt is bad.
I think I throw like 50 bucks a month into some IRA or something.
We're trying to put as much as we can more towards paying the credit card debt down than saving.
Money is not what rules my life, but I am, of course, concerned about retirement.
My Social Security is around $800 a month. About every 2 weeks when the bills are due, and that's when I get really worried.
Will I have an adequate income for as long as I'm on the road of life? But we don't know how long that road of life is going to be for anybody.
We joined forces with the New York Times to bring you stories about life's financial issues as they play out through the decades. Stay tuned for our special report on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. This week, we're dedicating the hour to your birthdays, the ones you mark as you pass through each decade of your life. In a special partnership with the New York Times, we fanned out across the country to talk with folks from their teens through their 70s about the money issues they face as they age. And then we paired them with a financial advisor around their same age and in similar circumstances. Starting us off today, Ron Lieber, the Your Money columnist for The Times and the lead in our special report called Money Through the Ages. Ron, what age is your money?
Well, some of my money is young and some of my money is slightly older, but I myself am 39 years old.
Excellent, excellent. All right. So you're dealing with money issues in your 30s. I'm dealing with them in my early 40s. But, you know, what I really found interesting in this project was how layered our money issues become over the years. You know, I thought there would be more and greater differences as you entered your 30s, your 40s, your 50s. But what really happens is that these issues start to compound, kind of like interest.
Well, here's what ends up happening, right? One of the points of the exercise here is to show people how, while there are different issues for people in different age or different demographic groups, like spending too much or saving too little or taking on too much debt. And these things can happen, you know, during any age, but they may impact you in different ways, depending on how old you are and when you start going down that road.
All right. First, you are going to kick us off with a teenager from Amherst, Massachusetts. Let's listen to his story.
My name is Benjamin Calton, but I go by Mino. I'm a senior at Amherst High School, and I'm 18 years old. I was actually quite the lemonade stand entrepreneur. One day on Mother's Day, I raised $6, and that was in the span of like 3 hours, so that was awesome. The earliest memory of money that I have is of not having enough. I don't remember my parents fighting about it. I remember them talking about it, you know, being concerned and worried like you do when you don't have enough money. But, you know, it was always something that we were all like really aware of. I have like a 10-second memory of using a lot less toothpaste than I used to. And it's just something that my dad said once, like, hey, Mino, you gotta use like less toothpaste, we gotta make this last. The money that I spend comes... I don't really spend money, now that I'm thinking about it. The money that I spend is always money that I've earned, or that my parents will pay for and then I'll pay them back, because I don't have a job until, or like a substantially paying job until soccer season when I can ref. So for instance, they paid for my gym membership for this part of the winter. The moment I have the money from refing, I'm going to hand it right back to them. I'm not uncomfortable around money. I'm uncomfortable having people's money if I'm afraid that I'm going to use it and then not be able to give it back. So I give it back because I know that like the money in our family, it's a communal fund. We had a meeting with my school's college guidance counselor, and at our first meeting, she asked us, how much can you pay for? And my parents said, you know, none. We got to get scholarships and financial aid and merit-based. The bottom line is that I'm looking for about $10,000 a year in scholarships, like external scholarships. At the same time that they won't be able to help very much, I'm also not expecting them to. In some ways, it's my education, and I'm going to be using the education that I've received to earn money back to pay for it. So at the same time, I don't feel like it's their responsibility. Although, you know, if they want to throw me a couple thousand, that's not something I'll complain about, you know.
Ron Lieber, you know, one of the things that we tried to do with this project was to find people who typified
their generation. And I have to tell you, he sounds awfully sophisticated about money as a teenager.
Yeah, you know, Mino is incredibly earnest and utterly responsible. And yet he is tortured almost by this decision that he has to make. And it's this, right? It's the question of how much debt should we go into? How much should we sacrifice for a private school when a perfectly good community college or public university is right down the road that might not require so much sacrifice of us?
Tell us who we brought in to talk to Mino about his financial situation.
We brought in a young man named Zach Bissonette, who's actually a senior at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, 22 years old, already the author of an excellent book called Debt-Free You that encourages families not to take on too much debt or any at all in pursuit of undergraduate education. And Zach actually came to meet with Mino in person. And Zach was practically foaming at the mouth with frustration while looking over Mino's financial aid award letters.
I think it's sleazy to send a letter to a student suggesting that their parents borrow $10,180. If you're going to suggest that someone borrow $10,000, you should send a letter to them.
The other thing that Zach found wanting was a passage in one of the letters that said, you know, the $10,000 in parent loans could, quote unquote, reduce your expenses for next year. He said, that's not how loans work. Loans don't reduce expenses. Loans increase expenses because you have to pay interest.
Well, other than the kind of immediate paying for college issue, is Mino optimistic about his future?
I think he is optimistic. He is, you know, sort of public-minded, and he just wants to be careful now about not putting himself in a position later where he has to sacrifice some of his ideals or some of his career goals in order to take on a job or an occupation that would serve only to repay his debts.
Ron Lieber of the New York Times starting us off with a teenager as we look at money through the ages throughout this program. Ron, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And now we move on to the roaring 20s. It's usually a decade full of financial firsts. First paycheck, first apartment, first bills, first student loan payments. If you're lucky like Mino, you got some money counseling early on. But if you didn't, and you graduated into the worst economy since the Great Depression?
Okay, that's good. What's for dinner anyway?
Salmon and chicken if the microwave starts working.
You might very well find yourself cooking dinner at the same address you had in high school, living in the same bedroom, working part-time for your dad. That's 25-year-old Courtney McNair's life, 3 years after graduating from Wellesley College in Massachusetts with a degree in political science and Spanish.
I still have hope, you know, that I'll win the lotto or something, and I'll be able to get my own place anyways.
Would it take the lotto at this point for you to be able to do that?
It might.
There's six potatoes and four people.
Cooking dinner four nights a week is how McNair pays the rent, so to speak, at her childhood home in the West Adams neighborhood of Los Angeles. Her folks don't charge actual rent because they know her money has to go toward other serious expenses. $40,000 in student loan debt, $2,000 in credit card bills, and $10,000 still to go on a car payment. But McNair appears surprisingly nonplussed about her situation.
I always assumed I'd live at home for a little while, save up money, and go.
A little while being?
Maybe a year or two. Mm-hmm. People in my generation, maybe their parents aren't as quick to kick them out.
After she graduated in 2008, McNair took the first job she was offered as a match coordinator with the Los Angeles Boys and Girls Club. It paid $25 an hour. But then she decided what she really wanted to do was teach special ed. Now she's back in school getting her master's degree. She's also tutoring and working part-time for a family foundation that provides low-cost legal services for special needs students.
Hello. Hi, Dad.
Hey.
Yeah, it's my dad. My boss.
Her parents, both lawyers, run the foundation. Dad, Greg, pays her $13 an hour. The two of them meet at least once a week for lunch at the family dining room table.
Did you get any information from Sergeant Barlow about the boot camp program?
No, he contacted you. At least that's what you said.
Okay.
McNair is part of what's being called the boomerang generation. They're saddled with huge student loans and a lousy job market. But what's most curious is they don't seem to mind. That's something McNair's mother, Margaret, has a tough time understanding.
It seems as though they're afraid, and that's a big change. You know, when I was in my 20s, I could not wait to get out there. I still think that every now and then I could use a reality check when someone tells me that they can't find a job.
For now, back in grad school, Courtney's loans are deferred, but when she's done, all told, she'll have more than $50,000 worth to pay off. Problem is, according to payscale.com, the starting salary for a special ed teacher is just $29,000 to $40,000.
You don't want to assume more student loan debt than what your salary will be when you graduate.
Lauren Lyons-Cole is a 29-year-old certified financial planner in New York. She says McNair's student debt load is pretty typical for her generation. And like many 20-somethings, Courtney hasn't done the math on what it's going to take to be in good financial shape.
So many young people don't understand that $40,000 a year, $50,000, even $60,000, it just really doesn't go far. Nobody's telling her that she has to go out and work on Wall Street or sell her soul, but the reality is that life is expensive.
Cole says McNair should start by asking her father for a raise. Advice she's choosing to ignore because she says it would be too awkward, but she might ask for a retirement fund contribution. McNair is also among the many, many young people who leave school without learning how to manage money.
I've always hated money. I don't like it. I'm scared of it.
Why?
I don't know. I think it was because when I was little, my grandma, who we lived with for a little bit before she passed away, she was horrible with money. She would blow through it. At the end of the month, she had no money. No money.
So Cole's advice is as simple as it gets. Make a budget. She reviewed Courtney's finances and found she has about $200 left after paying all her expenses each month. She said $80 of that should go directly into a savings account. The rest to a weekly allowance for herself.
Take that $30 at the beginning of the week, put it in your wallet. When it's gone at the end of the week, it's gone.
Once she has that habit down, Cole says, she needs to dream big. Think about how she wants her future to play out and how she's going to fund that future. It's a future McNair isn't exactly rushing toward.
I figure if I'm 30 living at home, there's something wrong.
But now at least she has some tools to start a financial journey.
I'd like to have savings. I love to travel. On my bucket list is to visit all 7 continents. And I'd love to be able to do that someday. Sooner than later.
That bucket list, of course, is going to cost money. And the reality of her student loans and other bills may put those dreams off for longer than she'd like. But one thing about Cole's advice stood out for McNair. At least, she says, she didn't think I'm the worst money handler in the world. Coming up, we journey into, dare I say it, middle age.
Look, turning 30 is not that big a deal.
Oh, really? Is that how you felt when you turned 30?
Why, God, why?
And I'm gonna be 40.
When?
Someday.
My name is Sally O'Malley. I'm proud to say I'm 50. 50 years old.
As we continue with Money Through the Ages on Marketplace Money from APM American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Sigh, we're getting older. As we continue Money Through the Ages, our special report in partnership with the New York Times. Your 30s are usually filled with enormous financial changes. You may be starting a family, buying a house, maybe moving from a starter job into something more like a career. We're going to hear from two very different couples now. The first got married 4 years ago, just bought a house, and welcomed their first child last month. Paul Sullivan is here to tell their story. He's the Wealth Matters columnist for the New York Times. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Welcome to the 30s.
I'm still in it myself. So it's
you
wonderful.
Are. Okay, well, then you'll be able to relate more than I am because it's behind me. But give us a quick thumbnail of the couple that you talked to.
Yeah, interesting couple, Bernardo Minot and Natalie Thornburg. They both have PhDs in microbiology and are researchers at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. They think they've been making good financial decisions along the way with a few hiccups here and there, but it turns out they're in a bit more of a pickle than they thought. you know, over years of college and graduate school, they use their credit cards perhaps a bit too often, and they're now saddled with about $35,000 in high-interest credit card debt.
Ouch. All right. Well, here's what Natalie and Bernardo said about their relationship with money.
I hate thinking about money. I really just want to have enough so that we have enough food on our table, that we have a safe home.
We don't live by money, or even now I don't feel like, you know, money is the main thing for me. I'd like Tyler to grow up so that he doesn't have to help us out.
Now, how typical do you think Natalie and Bernardo are financially?
I think they're very typical, and I think there are a lot of positive things to be taken away from their situation. They have this month-old son named Tyler, and he's been a wake-up call in some ways. They really want to get their financial house in order. You know, as part of my conversation with them, I paired them with a financial advisor in Portland, Oregon, and they need to be on a strict budget. They need to know exactly how much they're spending every month. They need to have a more robust emergency fund, and then they need to make sure they have some life insurance for this young child.
This debt obviously is what is really holding them down at this point. Let's hear what they said about paying that off.
We're trying to put as much as we can paying the credit card down than saving. We put things towards savings with kind of the thoughts in our brains of not long-term yet, it's kind of rainy day fund.
You know, it's sort of a catch-22. I feel like you want to pay off the high interest debt that you have as fast as you can, but at the same time, it feels good to have a little bit behind there, so...
We have to have something. We have to have something.
Yeah.
Paul, what are they doing in terms of thinking about the future? Are they even at that point yet?
They're not, and one of the shocks to them was just how large the rainy day fund would have to be to qualify as a legitimate rainy day fund. The advisor pointed out that a rainy day fund should be at least 6 months of expenses after taxes. That bumped that rainy day fund up to about $24,000 or $25,000. So it's a daunting amount of money to have to put aside.
Maybe they weren't so happy to hear from a financial planner.
Well, the interesting thing that they said is, you know, I talked to them the day after the financial planner spoke with them. They were very animated, and in an earlier clip when Natalie says she hates to think about money, she said it's changed a bit, and she wants to think about it more. And Bernardo was a bit wistful. He said he really wished that somewhere along the way he had been forced to take, or at least known about, some sort of, you know, financial planning course, something that would have taught him how to manage his money better. But, you know, the upside of this is, you know, they're 31 and 34, and they're happy to have heard about, you know, what they have to do at this point in their life. You know, as Bernardo says, they won't be a burden to Tyler down the road.
Paul Sullivan is the Wealth Matters columnist for the New York Times. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thanks, Tess.
And now we turn to Tara Siegel Bernard, also a scribe for the Times. She spent a day with the Sheltons of Beverly Hills, Michigan, a gay couple, also in their 30s. Tara, what makes their finances so different from Paul's couple?
Gay couples face a host of financial and legal issues that heterosexual married couples don't even need to worry about.
Well, tell us a little bit about this couple.
Sure. Amanda and Kay Shelton. Amanda's 34, Kay is 37, and they live in the suburbs of Detroit. They're raising their two children, Maya, who's 3 years old, and Miles, who is 8 months.
And what do Amanda and Kay do?
Amanda is a commercial litigator, and Kay is the stay-at-home parent, so she's home all day.
Presumably, they are not married, not legal in Michigan?
No, Michigan is one of the states that do not recognize same-sex unions in any form.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how their financial picture is different than, say, Natalie and Bernardo, the couple that we just heard from. What kinds of rights do they have and not have when it comes to money?
Since Kay isn't earning any money as the stay-at-home parent, she can't really take advantage of any tax advantage retirement savings vehicles like a 401k or an IRA, because you need earned income to contribute to a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA. On top of that, she isn't entitled to receive Social Security benefits on Amanda's record because they're not legal spouses in the eyes of the federal government. So she's really in a precarious position.
I know I need to save for her, and I'm not. I know I need to save more for me than I am, but I really haven't thought beyond that of what else needs to happen.
What about some of the other really big financial categories, like taxes and insurance?
Well, they don't really have much wiggle room on the tax front because If they were a heterosexual married couple, they'd be able to file their returns jointly. Because they can't, they pay about $3,000 more than an identical couple with identical income that is able to marry.
Let's talk about their overall financial situation. What kind of money is coming in the door and what's going out?
Well, Amanda earns about $130,000. Kay isn't bringing any money because she's got a full-time job at home with the little ones. Their biggest expense is their mortgage.
We're kind of in a difficult spot. It can't move because the market has plummeted. You know, we bought this house in 2004, which was almost right at the height of the bubble.
How much did you buy it for at the time?
$340,000. And it is probably worth...
It depends. Yeah, somewhere between $250,000 and $280,000, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So
they're underwater.
Way underwater.
What are some of the other ways that their finances are changed by the fact that they are a same-sex partnership? What would happen if they split up?
Yeah, that's another serious challenge that they face. They own their home jointly. They're both on the mortgage. They're both on the title. The problem there is that since they're now married, there's no divorce court to go to divvy up their assets.
So is there any legal document that they could draw up? I mean, can you have a prenup when you don't get married?
Yes. Both the attorney and financial planner I spoke with suggested two documents, a domestic partner agreement and a co-parenting agreement, both which would be protecting Kay for the most part because she has no legal ties to the children and she's not earning any money, yet she's working all day long.
What other advice did your expert have for Amanda and Kay as they have merged their financial lives together?
They've been together for 13 years. They have, you know, joint checking accounts. They own their homes jointly. Most of their assets are owned jointly. In this case, it means that most of those assets would pass to one another directly. It would bypass the, you know, often lengthy and costly probate process to settle a deceased person's estate. So in that case, it's a good thing in that they would have, you know, immediate access to the checking account since they're both on it. They do, however, need to update their wills. The lawyer also suggested putting language in there that Kay should be treated as a co-parent just so that there isn't any confusion, because she also did say that, you know, even the ring that your partner gives you would go to your biological family without a will in place.
Okay. Sounds like they have a long to-do list.
Yes, indeed.
All right, Tara, thanks so much, and we'll be talking to you later in the show with a couple, I believe, in their 60s.
Thanks, Tess.
So as you can see, finances really start to get complicated in mid-adulthood. We've got all kinds of tools and links at marketplace.org/money to help you sort through priorities. And don't miss all the extras available through the print and online versions of Money Through the Ages at nytimes.com/ages. So 40 is the new 30, right? Life begins at 40 and all that? Well, commentator J.D. Roth could not agree more. And we asked him to give us a sense of what makes the 40s so financially fabulous, at least for him.
Here's a confession. The best thing about being in my 40s is I don't worry as much about money. But I didn't get there overnight. I used to worry about money a lot. In my 30s, I was careless with cash and credit. I bought whatever I wanted, usually computers and comic books, and I never thought about the future. I was the proverbial grasshopper. I sang the summer away while the ants saved for winter. And guess what? I racked up more than $35,000 in debt by the time I was 34. Eventually, I realized I needed to stop worrying and do something. I paid off my debt. I changed careers, and I stopped comparing myself to my friends. Now that I've reached my 40s, my financial life finally seems stable, solid even. It took a while, but I've made the transition from grasshopper to ant, from spender to saver. And it's a transition that many of my friends have made, too. I hear the same stories from them. We did the things we thought we were supposed to do, buy a house, buy new cars, have kids. But now that we're entering middle age, we care less what other people think. It's more fun to follow our own goals. And many of us are discovering that we have enough. We've already bought everything we need, and we realize it's senseless to buy everything we want. It probably helps that most 40-somethings earn more money than they did in their 20s and 30s, often a lot more. Still, our extra income is being poured into Roth IRAs and 401ks. Why? Because we failed to think about retirement in our 30s. Now we feel the pressure to save as fast as we can. We're making up for lost time. So, when you hit your 40s, your lifestyle doesn't really change much. Well, except for kids. Most people my age have children, and these kids are getting older and more expensive. Then there's the cost of college. Some folks are faced with a tough choice. Do I save for retirement, or do I help put my kids through school? The lucky ones can do both. I think it's ironic, really, that in our 40s, we're more focused on the future than we were in our 20s and 30s, back when we actually had more of a future to focus on.
J.D. Roth writes about personal finance at GetRichSlowly.org. All right, for the 50s, we are making beautiful music. At this point in your life, you may well be asking, oh, wait a minute, what exactly does my future look like? For some answers to that question, we head to Tucson, Arizona.
My name is Marina Sturm. I'm 55 years old and I live in Tucson, Arizona. I play with the American Symphony in New York City. Well, I'm also a professor at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and so I'm really a freelance musician. American Symphony is part-time, and so I fly in and play so many concerts a year. Since I've become a professor, I'd cut down on the amount of times I go back and forth. It's getting more and more expensive. I think anybody in the arts is seeing a real change, and obviously in education, higher education, we're extremely concerned. We're getting pay cuts or furloughs. So everything I seem to choose to like to do is not having a very good time in this recession. I tend to live pretty frugally, and money was never a motivating factor for me in choosing my career. My father was a professional musician, and I knew that, also being a teacher, that these were not places that I'd make a lot of money. Money is not what rules my life, but I am, of course, concerned about retirement. I think when you're in your 30s, you never think like that. Then 40s, you go, oh, I still got time. And then all of a sudden, 50s, you go, whoops. I mean, I don't know, without having children and things, I feel like I probably should have saved more, but I traveled a lot, I still travel a lot, and I'm quite happy about it. I'm not very smart with money. I could use some help. I perhaps haven't been that wise with it, and I'm not shrewd at all. I think I'm kind of naive about it, and also I don't want to think about it. Not that I don't want to think about aging and all that. I don't want to think about money. I want it to just, it's sort of like I try to have a relationship with it, kind of like music. I try not to have it rule me or fear it too much. It's all it is money.
Carmen Wong Ulrich is now with us. She's a personal finance journalist and the author of The Real Cost of Living. And she spent the day with Marina at her home in Tucson, Arizona. Hi, Carmen.
Hello, Tess. Thanks for having me.
Marina, first off the bat, said that money was not a motivating factor for her in choosing her career. But I'm going to start with money. What kind of money is she bringing in from these two jobs?
She's bringing in around, in total, $60-something thousand a year. But she mentioned the furloughs, and she's looking at possible 5% pay cuts down the road.
Well, you know, one of the things that I was struck by in the tape was that point where she says, you're in your 30s, you think, oh, I'm okay. You're in your 40s, you think, oh, I still got time. And then 50s, she says, whoops, too late. It's not too late, is it?
Not at all. You know, she was put into action, basically, and she has money saved up in retirement, 4 separate IRAs from past jobs. She has some pension, not a big one, but it's some pension, and Social Security. So, you know, she's in pretty good shape compared to a lot of people, but she moved in her mother.
Into her home?
Yes, in her home, yeah, that she bought in Tucson. And she's 89. She's in great health. But this type of lifestyle change at 55, it's very important, vital to look at your money and to really make some big decisions.
So what is she most concerned about at this point in her life? How different are the 40s from the 50s?
Well, in your 40s, you can still say, you know, I think 20 years is kind of seems like a quasi-magic number in our heads. Well, I've got 20 years. Once you hit your 50s.
You don't have 20 years anymore.
Yeah. And if you want to retire at 65.
Right.
And in terms of all the rules of, you know, long-term investing and long-term growth, you always want to have at least 20 years to sock money away and invest it. And I think that a lot of folks in their 50s, a lot of boomers especially, are taking care of aging parents. And this is definitely the age where your lifestyle changes and your responsibilities change.
Who was our financial advisor and what were some of the recommendations that this person made?
Our financial advisor was Kimberly Overman, founder of The Financial Well, and she's out in Florida, and she's 52 years old. She's also single, no children. And her advice to Marina was pretty much to organize. And this was the first time that she'd ever really pulled together her finances. And the most basic part of Kimberly's advice was actually the most painful for Marina, and that was budgeting. That was something Marina has never done. And when Kimberly asked her, can you see where your money goes on a daily basis, when you go to get your coffee, when you go to the grocery store? And she says that that runs counter to the musician mind. You know, this kind of hunt and peck is not very fun.
Well, how typical is Marina's situation for a 50-year-old?
Yeah, having and taking care of an aging parent in your 50s is becoming more and more common. And for most folks in their 50s who have children, what's really common is the battle between college costs and taking care of the aging parents and their retirement. You really do have to take care of yourself in order to take care of other people. Another great piece of advice that Kimberly's worked through with Marina is to consider, in her case, long-term care insurance. Mm. Because Marina doesn't have anyone, no children, to take care of her. And you also don't want to bankrupt children either, but long-term care insurance can cost a lot. But in terms of Marina's case, Kimberly said, let's cut the benefit to 50% of your expenses. Let's limit it to 3 years. So when you start kind of chopping away at it, you still have the coverage, but it's at a more manageable cost. So she came up with a plan that's closer to what Marina pays in auto insurance.
Hmm.
For Marina, who doesn't have anyone really to care for her, it makes more sense.
Carmen Wong Ulrich is a personal finance journalist and the author of The Real Cost of Living. Carmen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tess.
Coming up, time marches on.
You're getting old.
I'm not old.
You're not young. This is the way it goes, Davis. One day it dawns on you that you're starting to get old. Then it dawns on you that you are old.
You know, getting old really sucks. I'm starting to feel like this old typewriter here. Forget the fountain of youth. We need a fountain of smart.
It is never too late to wrangle your money as we continue with Money Through the Ages on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. And now we tread softly into the golden years. As we continue Money Through the Ages, our special report in partnership with the New York Times. Our next story is from Tampa, Florida, where a couple of 60-somethings are heading toward retirement. At least they hope they are. The New York Times' Tara Siegel-Bernard is back with us. Hi, Tara.
Hi, Tess.
Tell us a little bit about Jim and Frances Langerfeld.
Fran is 62. Jim is 64. They've raised 4 children, and now they're contemplating retirement. But they have a lot of the same questions that other retirees face. You know, do we have enough money? How much will we really get for our house? Can we afford to do this now? Should we wait? And Fran is a meticulous record keeper. She pulled out a budget book from 1968.
Wow.
Yeah. And she had a stack of them in her garage. It was really fascinating.
So as they went through those records with you, what were they saying about how they had planned for retirement?
If it was up to Fran, she works as a legal processor, she would have retired yesterday. Jim, who is an engineer for a construction firm, still enjoys his job. So they think they've come up with the ideal compromise. They own a vacation home in New Brunswick in Canada. While Fran was trying to come up with a value for their home, she came across an ad for a motel. The asking price is about $225,000 Canadian dollars. And she thought this might be the ideal solution.
I had never once in my life thought about running a motel. And I don't know why, suddenly it just hit me. And I thought, wait, you know, that's probably a pretty good idea.
To buy and run a hotel?
It would give Jim something to do. He is a master fix-it man. He repairs everything around the house, fixes the cars.
Well, he can move in with me as far as I'm concerned.
I know, me too. And she is obviously a meticulous bookkeeper, so yeah. They thought that they had the skills to do this.
Let's get back to that plan in a moment and talk about what their financial situation is right now. How much money have they set aside for retirement?
They've saved about $720,000. They also own their home in Florida.
Do they still have a mortgage or is it paid off?
It's completely paid off.
Good for them.
Yeah. They do have a tiny bit of debt, you know, considering, and they have a 401k loan. So Fran, I believe, is paying herself back.
So it sounds like they're pretty well set financially. What is keeping them from going ahead and pulling the trigger?
Well, $700,000, you know, might sound like a lot of money to a lot of families, but once you break that down, it would produce, with Social Security, about $67,000 a year. However, most of their retirement assets are in taxable accounts. So any money they pull out, they're going to be paying ordinary income taxes. So that $67,000 then becomes, according to our financial planner, about $50,000.
So who was our financial planner and what were the main suggestions?
Sure. I spoke with Kathleen Real, who is a 64-year-old financial planner who's also contemplating a phased retirement. So she discovered that their portfolio is comprised of 76% in stocks.
Wow. In their 60s.
So that's really risky.
Were the Langerfelds aware of that? Or is that just something that they had kind of let happen?
Yes. Fran was acutely aware. It sounded as if she was, you know, making a few bets to kind of bring their retirement nest egg up to speed because they didn't have enough.
Well, was the financial planner concerned at all?
Yeah, she was very concerned, and she suggested no more than 45% in equities. And also simplify, because they have investments scattered across a variety of brokerage firms. As we age, you know, it just becomes more difficult to manage. So better to just simplify and, you know, have everything in one place.
Any other advice that the advisor had in terms of them being prepared to make a big move like this?
Yeah, I mean, ideally speaking, she would like to see them work a little bit longer. She also raised, you know, a lot of questions about the hotel. You know, do you have an exit strategy? It's something that she wants them to be absolutely sure of.
Well, given that Frances wants to retire yesterday, was she a bit crestfallen at this recommendation?
No, I think it was probably what she was expecting. And that's why they're on the fence. They're thinking about it seriously. They're definitely going in with their eyes wide open.
Tara Siegel-Bernard is a personal finance reporter for The New York Times, and we've been talking to her about this couple in their 60s. Tara, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tess.
And once again, I'll remind you that we've got all kinds of extras for you at marketplace.org/money. And don't miss the outstanding work of our partners over at The Times at nytimes.com/ages.
What a drag it is getting old.
If there's one common thread through every single one of the decades we've profiled here today, it is the need to save for retirement. It is quite literally never too early to start that effort. Most of us haven't saved nearly enough at any decade. In fact, the Employee Benefit Research Institute recently found the majority of Americans have stashed away less than $25,000 for their golden years. But even those people are in better financial shape than 70-year-old Susanna Wilson, who saved nothing. We went to visit Wilson at her home in Grass Valley, California, earlier this month. She was still digging out from a fierce snowstorm when we arrived.
Hi, very nice to meet you. Who is this?
This is Rooney.
Rooney, hi.
Grass Valley is an old gold mining town of just 12,000 people at the foot of the Sierra Nevadas. Wilson lives in the house she grew up in, When she moved back a few years ago, she took out a mortgage to put in a new roof and foundation and update the small, cozy kitchen.
So, I made some soup for you so we can have quick lunch. Did you eat already?
Oh, that's so sweet. No, we haven't.
Good.
Thank you.
She fed us butternut squash soup with a salad and some local sourdough bread. But by the time we left, I wished we had paid her for such a lovely meal.
My Social Security is around $800 a month, and I have a small mortgage on this house, and I have electric, and I have a dog that needed to have his teeth cleaned. And I have a
right on cue.
Right on cue. And I have a 12-year-old car, so it's really tough.
Tough doesn't begin to cover it. Wilson subsists on those government checks, plus a one-day-a-week job at a local jewelry store that pays $12.50 an hour. She also makes dresses for little girls. But she only sells about six a month for around $200 extra. All told, a really good month nets her around $1,400. A third of that goes toward fixed expenses like utilities, insurance, and property taxes. She pays $300 toward that mortgage we mentioned. And the balance goes toward the monthly minimum payments on $9,000 in credit card debt, racked up over the years for daily living expenses.
I can never retire. I will never be able to retire.
How do you manage?
I don't know. I try.
What do you fear most at this point?
That I will become disabled and not be able to work.
What happens if that happens?
I don't know. I guess I sell my house.
One of her credit card statements helpfully points out that it will take her 70 years to pay the card off if she continues to send only the minimums.
I probably about every 2 weeks when the bills are due, and that's when I get really worried. I think I might just have to declare bankruptcy. It's the credit card debt. I just can't live with that.
It should never have come to this. Wilson attended Berkeley in the late 1950s, though she left before graduating to move to New York and marry her college sweetheart, the minimalist sculptor Walter de Maria. She spent her prime earning years as a designer in New York. Her clothing line, O Susanna, sold in the late 70s at retailers like Saks and Bloomingdale's. National magazines featured her perfumes, including a popular fragrance called Strawberry Love. In her 40s, Wilson moved back to California and became a publicist. At her peak, she made around $65,000 a year. But after two divorces and a child, not a penny of that made its way into a retirement fund.
One thing kind of led to another, that I slid into another business, slid into another. I always thought that the business I was in was going to be a great success and I would be able to sell it or something like that.
We have a tendency to either use the income that we generate in our business to build the business or to enjoy the fruits of our labor now rather than thinking about the future.
Elizabeth Baer is a 67-year-old certified financial planner in Lansing, Michigan, who reviewed Wilson's finances for us. She says a lack of retirement savings is far too typical for small business owners, and Wilson is an example of that.
She's living on a subsistence of... Well, let's just say it's not a wonderful diet. She's barely eating appropriately, trying to meet these expenses. And, of course, the biggest drain is her debt.
So Baer recommends a reverse mortgage. Those allow older homeowners to tap their home equity, and they don't have to repay anything until they leave the house. Baer says she's never recommended a reverse mortgage before, but that Wilson is an ideal candidate. She could potentially wrap in her $5,000 mortgage and then take cash out. Wilson is also part owner, with her two brothers, of several tracts of timberland in Northern California. Baer says they must consider selling.
Whatever the purpose of this land was before, today's the rainy day, and she needs to generate some significant capital. It may not be that much, but at this point, $25,000 would change her life totally.
Since talking with Baer, Wilson has started to pursue both suggestions. And she's continuing to live by Baer's advice to be strong and hang tough. Perhaps the one comfort Wilson can take in her own situation is that she's got a lot of company as an older American who just didn't save and now lives in fear of what comes next. Overcoming that fear may be the key to recovering her financial health, and she's confident, somewhat, that that will happen.
Well, I don't want to be a Pollyanna, but tomorrow's another day. Yeah, tomorrow's always another day.
And finally this hour, the financial wisdom that can come with age. Denby Brandon Jr. has been counseling people about their finances for more than half a century. He's the author of the definitive History of Financial Planning and one of the creators of the Certified Financial Planner designation. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's really good to be here.
You are 83 years old and you are still working. I hope it's not because you didn't save enough for retirement.
Actually, we do practice what we preach, and so the truth is that I really haven't had to work for about 25 years. But believe it or not, when I suddenly realized I didn't have to work anymore, I couldn't find anything I'd rather do. And so I just have no present plans for retiring, and that's been about 18 or 20 years ago.
All right. What are some of your financial issues right now? We've been profiling money issues throughout the decades. What do you think is unique to your 80s?
Well, as life progresses, you need to plan for and attempt to cope with what I call new normals that in finance and life that actually become periodic realities. And in the 80s, people are trying to decide, should I stay in a private home? Should I go to a retirement community? Questions of where to live. But the basic issue always is, will I have an adequate income for as long as I'm on the road of life? But the problem with answering that question is that we don't know how long that road of life is going to be for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, in life, we're tenants without a lease, subject to eviction without notice, you know. We don't know what's adequate because we don't know what might happen along the way. But we do think that planning does make a difference.
You mentioned, of course, that we are all subject to eviction from this lifetime. And I think that's something that people struggle with throughout the years, that despite all the calculators that are available, all of the studies that you can read about how much you should save for retirement, people just don't know how much they need to sock away.
That's absolutely true. And let me tell you what the honest answer to that is. When people do retire, it's really an adventure, and you really don't know for a few years how much you really need. And so you can have numbers, but until you really experience it, you don't really know. And since people are living longer, we really need to plan for that next decade and maybe even further.
Well, then, is the advice as simple as plan as though you're going to live to be 100 years old? And if you don't get that far, then, well, maybe somebody's going to get a really nice chunk of change when you depart.
Absolutely. For every client, we use the number 95. As a minimum.
Really?
Yes. You just can't tell how long anybody's going to live. And we would say at least to 95, and you better have some surplus even then.
You know, I want to quote something that Ron Lieber wrote in the Your Money special section on this this week. He said, if we could tackle these things when they first present themselves, these financial issues, they wouldn't become problems that last for decades.
I would even go much deeper than that. All through life, normal changes. And if you plan for it and try to get skills to cope with it, you're a lot more likely to be able to deal effectively with it. It's a long process that really wins the day. There's no pill, but there is a process that improves your odds of coping well.
Denby Brandon has been in financial services for the last 60 years. He literally wrote the book on financial planning. Mr. Brandon, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Before we wrap up our coverage of Money Through the Ages, I wanted to note a pattern that emerged at various points of the show.
I've always hated money. I don't like it. I'm scared of it.
I hate thinking about money. I really hate it.
Money is not what rules my life. And also, I don't want to think about it.
Oh, people, don't be a hater. Be a planner. We'll help you through it. And a big shout out to our good friends at the New York Times this week, especially our close collaborator Ron Lieber, plus Claudia Payne, Kevin McKenna, Jim Schachter, and Josh Williams. You can see a full list of contributors at marketplace.org. Don't forget to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins, Stephen Hoffman, and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.